This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. WGLT broke the news yesterday that Bloomington City Manager David Hales may be looking for a job. He was a finalist for the city administrator position in Racine, Wisconsin, until he says he pulled himself from the search. Bloomington Mayor Terry Renner, if reelected, would help choose the city's next city manager and has said as much in a May 2016 interview. We'll also talk about the city's audit and a report from the city's fire chief. Terry, as always, thanks for joining us on Sound Ideas.
Thanks, Mike. Good to be here.
Let's start with the news regarding David Hales. What's your reaction?
The council did extend Mr. Hales' contract last spring until July 12th of 2018. So with an 18-month contract, I think, you know, it's not perhaps surprising that somebody might be exploring other opportunities. But we would have to see what happens after the election and circle back with the council and Mr. Hales to see whether or not there was an extension of his current contract that would be possible.
Would you anticipate either the council or City Manager Hales wanting to go in that direction, looking for an extension?
I think we need to—I don't know what the council, because I don't know what the makeup of the council will be, but we would have to have that discussion, you know, in the summer, probably fall, just because in case he was not interested or there was a majority in the council that did not want to extend his contract, then we would have to begin the 5 to 8, 9 month process of looking for another city manager. But at this point, obviously, we depends on what happens on April 4th. We'll see what the new council is. And elections do matter across the board.
City managers, their tenure averages 7, 8 years, somewhere in that range.
Somewhere around. They're kind of like, I'm liking them to provosts, you know. And I used to work for the International City County Management Association back in the late 1980s. And, you know, we'd always realize that, you know, that you go from one community to another to provide expertise. Sometimes a community is looking for someone to help stabilize the finances. When Mr. Hales was hired, that's absolutely what was necessary. The city almost couldn't make payroll back in 2009. And sometimes cities are interested in a different kind of skill set, maybe economic development. And, yeah, again, city managers tend to go 5, 7, 8 years. That's so, not atypical.
So City Manager Hales is sort of pushing the outer boundaries of that. Is it time for a change for the city of Bloomington? Does David Hales' skill set in terms of rearranging the budget or really focusing on, you know, meeting payroll as he had to do when he first came on board,
he certainly did a great amount to stabilize our finances, and our finances are stable. We had a budget workshop this past Saturday, but we still have some budgetary challenges going forward, and we also have now capital improvement plans in place that Mr. Hales has been spearheading. So at this point, we just have to wait till after the election and have a conversation with the council.
We talked about this in May of 2016 when Hales was given a contract that upped his pay by 2.3% and set an expiration date of July 12, 2018. Here's what you said in May of last year.
What this does mean, though, is assuming I run and am reelected, pretty much after I get reelected, assuming that happens and I'm sworn in, we're going to have to begin the process of seeking a new city manager. And that would potentially involve an 8, 9, 10 month selection process.
Is that still the plan?
Well, essentially, what I should have added and clarified at that time and now is obviously this is a council decision, and it depends on who's on the council. So, you know, we'll see after the election and begin to have that conversation probably over the summer, and a conversation with Mr. Hales too, whether or not he would seek, you know, an extension of his contract.
If the council does decide to move forward with a new city manager, what sort of skill set would you like to see in the next city manager?
Well, I think again,
they could be the same qualities, some of the same qualities that David Hales has.
Correct.
Just wondering what you as mayor might look for.
For me as mayor, definitely a financial background, but we're really putting the pedal to the metal on economic development in this community. And so downtown revitalization, we got a downtown plan passed. We've got the Route 66 Visitor Center. We've got Green Top Grocery on Constitution Trail. And the list goes on. Hy-Vee and Dick's Sporting Goods and Kroger Superstore. So we are trying to put the pedal to the metal on economic development. And, you know, we're making progress. We're moving forward. And so if Mr. Hales were to decide not to seek, you know, extension, or if there was a majority in the council that did not want to provide an extension, then I think that's something that I would push as mayor. And obviously, at the end of the day, it'll also depend on what the council says.
That's Mayor Terry Renner. The community's mayors join us most Tuesdays following Monday evening council meetings. Next week, you'll hear from Mayor Chris Koos. The city has a clean audit. What does that mean?
Well, there are no red flags in our process. Now, that let's also be clear that that's not the Coliseum Fund, because the Coliseum...
And that's my next question. Yeah, why isn't the Coliseum included? Why was it excluded?
As the auditor said, they didn't think they would be able to get enough information because we had the transition between SIAM and VenueWorks, and there was also an investigation currently going on. So it will be audited. We just need to get more information and have the investigation finished. Now, by red flags, I mean, essentially, we have the second highest bond rating possible, and we certainly always have come
That's
in.
That's not a red flag.
That's not a red flag. And we've always come in under budget. We're handling our finances, as prudently as possible. And we have a lot of good pre-auditing. For example, if you go to a conference, you don't just get to order whatever you want. You're given whatever, $3 and something for breakfast or $5 for lunch, whatever, regardless of what it costs. So certainly when you go to a place like Washington, D.C., you're on a pretty tight budget.
So the Coliseum was excluded because of the transition from Central Illinois Arena Management, or SIAM, and VenueWorks.
Correct.
SIAM is now under investigation. Where does that investigation stand?
I don't know, and even if I did, I couldn't talk about it publicly. I'm sorry.
Is there a timeline that you're aware of when the investigation might be wrapped up?
No.
Do you think the Coliseum will remain a contentious issue for some people forever?
I hope not. I mean, it. What I'm hoping is with the new management at VenueWorks, and we still have some kinks to work out with VenueWorks. For example, the management of their concessions. Some of the lines are just way too long at peak times. So we do have some issues that we have to work out with them. But I'm certainly hopeful that we can, within a couple years perhaps, get the Coliseum to break even in its operating budget at least. And if we get more, if we have an anchor in downtown, if we get more gigs in the Coliseum, it'll become more of a destination. So, and of course, the front and center building that we've talked about before is down as part of our revitalization of downtown, will help link the Coliseum to the core of the downtown and the visitor center. Right now, it's kind of off on its own. And the Convention and Visitors Bureau, keeps track of a lot of conferences, sometimes couple dozen really big conventions or conferences we don't get because there's not a hotel nearby or sufficient parking.
During City Manager Hale's last Sound Ideas interview on January 31st, he placed a great deal of confidence in VenueWorks to turn around the Coliseum's finances. Here's what he had to say on January 31st.
Even before we had a change in management, there was one year where the operating loss was less than $50,000. It took a long time to get to that. So we've been close to that, and I think we will hit that in the near future. Now, again, it could take 2 to 3 years, but I think we'll eventually get there based on everything I've seen and what VenueWorks can bring to the table to help us be even more aggressive in not only expense management, but also more aggressive in trying to book revenue-generating events.
City Manager David Hales from earlier this year saying the Coliseum is on a path to break even to fund its operation. You agree with that?
That's, I think I'm hopeful. But I'm cautiously optimistic. I like to, frankly, under-promise and over-deliver.
Sure.
So I don't want to make any predictions. But that's our goal. Our goal would be to have at least the Coliseum break even in operating. And if that's happening, that means we're getting more events. People are going to be coming downtown. There'll be more economic spillover benefits. And hopefully, if we can get an anchor project that we've been working on, I think that can't help but improve the Coliseum's bottom line.
The mayors of both Bloomington and Normal are Sound Ideas guests most Tuesdays following Monday evening council meetings. It's Mayor Renner's turn this Tuesday. Let's talk about the report from the city's fire chief, Brian Moore. What did you hear last night?
Well, essentially, we've got a great fire department, and the thing that we do need to do is to improve response times in the northeast part of Bloomington. And this is maybe an area where we might want to work with the town of Normal. They have some of the very same problems. Mayor Kuss and I have talked about this since I was first elected, about some possibilities. Now, it'd be very difficult to have the same firehouse that is staffed by Bloomington and Normal firefighters, but it might be very possible for us, one of the two communities, to build a firehouse and staff it and contract with the other. Normal, for example, contracts with Towanda to provide them with fire service.
Wasn't there a meeting scheduled just after the Metro Zone vote that was canceled because of the Metro Zone regarding this exact same topic?
I don't know that that was the reason it was canceled. I believe Mark Peterson canceled the meeting. You'd have to ask Mark Peterson. I don't think that he canceled it because of a Metro Zone situation.
So how far off the response times is the fire department in the Northeast Quadrant? We're talking Northeast about Quadrant parts are all of Wards 3, 5, and 9.
Right. Well, essentially what we're hoping to do is to get the national standard of 90% of your calls being answered in 6 minutes, right? In the Northeast Quadrant, I forgot the exact figure, but it was 8 minutes and some seconds. So we need to bring those down by a little over 2 minutes. Now, well, there is additional funding in the budget so that we can address some of those issues, but ultimately we're going to need a physical structure or maybe contract with Normal if they build a firehouse, however we do that. We both have the same kinds of issues, and these are life safety issues. And so
Are they also financial issues? Does this affect someone's home insurance, those response times?
It can if we have a very highly rated fire department, but certainly that can affect that. But the most important thing is 911 calls. That is one of the most important things, if not the most important thing, that city government does.
What about other additions? A new paramedic crew in the next fiscal year?
Correct. Yes. And then that's partly to address the 911 issues. And especially if it's, if you're talking about a fire can escalate in an extra 2 minutes, and that's bad. But what's even worse in terms of loss of property would be loss of life. If somebody is ill or having a heart attack, we want to be able to get out there as soon as possible.
All of these fold into the budget discussions you had on Saturday during a work session. How did that work session go on Saturday?
I think it went generally very well. We had presentations from not just the finance department, but many of the different department heads. And so we have obviously a balanced budget. We always, as I say, return money back. We always come in under budget. And so I think generally speaking, we're doing well. We have capital improvement challenges. We got to figure out how are we going to pay for our sewers and many other capital projects moving forward.
Can you compare this year's budget process with past years? You're sort of hanging the budget on this new framework of the city's capital improvement plan, or CIP. How is that working?
I think it's going well. I mean, this is the least acrimonious budget that we've had.
Well, it's easier when you have money.
It's easier, right, when you have had money. And frankly, we also have had some things. Our sales taxes are generally flat, but we have had the first full year of Hy-Vee in terms of sales taxes. And so, yeah, our revenues are flat, but we managed to make sure that we balance the budget regardless, without any tax or fee increases.
And the CIP is working out well, having this all sort of divided out by department and seeing their needs
correct
over the next 5 years and being able to determine what they need this year, next year, the year after.
Right. And that's also where we have the challenges of how do we pay for it. Now, when you hear a price tag of $141 million on sewers, well, sewers these days can last 100 years. So if we floated a bond for 30 years, we're still being fiscally responsible. So it's not like we've got to have this, we pay for this out of this week's paycheck, because these, by definition, capital projects are long-term investments in your community. And that's as soon as the new council is seated, that's going to be one of the top priorities for us to discuss.
And a new mayor, how's the campaign going?
I think the campaign's going fine, but there are only two ways to run an election, that is unopposed and scared. So I'm making sure that, I had very good news with the first election in February, but I need people to get back out again.
A lot of interest, a lot of public April. Outreach, a lot of forums. That's good news, isn't it?
Right. And we got a good ground game, GOTV, Get Out the Vote operation. And that's critical, particularly because, unfortunately, there only 15% of people turned out in February. Maybe we'll hit 20. 21 was the percentage of voter turnout for the last municipal election. So we're trying to make sure that people realize that there really is a choice and, take the message that Bloomington's on the right track.
Okay. Terry, thanks for your time on Sound Ideas.
Thank you.
As always.
Take care.
Mayor Renner is in a re-election campaign for his second term, running against Ward 1 Alderman Kevin Lauer. Both will meet in a GLT League of Women Voters candidate forum on March 28th, and questions are being accepted right now at WGLT.org. This is Sound Ideas.
Support for GLT comes from Martin's Home Furniture, presenting their new HGTV Home Design Studio by Bassett. They can help you custom design your own chair, sofa, or sectional, down to the firmness of the cushions at Martin's Home Furniture in Bloomington. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
It's Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. Two former Central Illinois congressional candidates will speak tonight at the Stand Up for Justice rally on the lawn of the BCPA. The rally is focused on the bill to replace Obamacare. One of the speakers is Democrat Junius Rodriguez, a Eureka College professor who challenged 18th District Congressman Darren LaHood. He's not announced plans to run again, but David Gill, who has run five times, has announced a sixth try for Congress. He'd face Congressman Rodney Davis in the 13th District. Dr. Gill works as an emergency room physician at a couple of area hospitals and just came off an overnight shift. So, Dr. Gill, we appreciate your time this morning on Sound Ideas.
Thanks, Mike. It's good to be here.
Dr. Gill, what do you think of the GOP's American Health Care Act as it's written?
Well, I think it represents a tragic shame, really, with regards to where healthcare and healthcare financing are going in this country. You know, as you're probably aware, I was not the biggest backer of Obamacare. I thought that there were two or three nice features to it, but that it really didn't strike at the main problem with healthcare financing in our country, which is the presence of the insurance industry. You know, the insurance industry actually wrote Obamacare. The employees of WellPoint would go back and forth to Senator Max Baucus's office and help put that whole package together. And there's good things in it. The fact that a child can stay on a parent's policy till they're 26, the fact that pre-existing conditions don't keep you from getting health insurance, the fact that there's no longer a lifetime cap. You know, I think those are all good features and everybody acknowledges that. But it left the insurance companies in charge and they insist on taking their pound of flesh, as it were, one way or the other.
So instead of repeal and replace, you were more in favor of fix Obamacare.
Yes, very much so. I'm a longtime advocate, 25-year advocate of a single-payer healthcare system, an improved Medicare for all. And unfortunately, they didn't let that be part of the process back there in 2009, 2010, and certainly they haven't allowed it to be a part of the process now. And instead, what we're getting now is a shame in which 24 million people are going to lose their health insurance, premiums are going to rise for the vast majority of Americans, and there's going to be $600 billion in tax cuts for the wealthiest people in our country.
Republicans say Obamacare is collapsing. The president says it's imploding, yet 20 million people have coverage. The uninsured rate is at its lowest level. Healthcare costs are rising at the slowest pace since the 1960s. Despite threats to repeal it, 9 million people enrolled in 2017, and public opinion of Obamacare is rising. More than 50% of Americans thinks it's a good idea. What do you think? Is it collapsing? Is it imploding? Or is it working at some level?
What's imploding is that the insurance companies are trying to exit from it because they're not meeting the profit margin that they desire. They used to operate at a 30 to 40% profit margin pre-Obamacare, and now they're in the 20, 25% range, and that's not sufficient for them. You know, one needs to understand that insurance companies have nothing to do with healthcare. They're not involved in this to make people healthy. Their mission statement is that they are to maximize profit, and they're not meeting the expectations of their shareholders at this point, and so that's why so many of them are backing out of Obamacare in different states.
The GOP plan would eliminate subsidies and replace them with tax rebates based on age. What effect might that have on the risk pool?
Well, again, the risk pool is really impacted by the fact that you're not going to have the mandatory enrollment any longer.
And the individual mandate.
Right. And insurance programs work best when everybody's in, and especially when you have healthy individuals in. And I think that was designed well within Obamacare. Unfortunately, it did result in a lot of small business people, myself included, I'm an independent contractor, seeing a drastic rise in their premiums, again, because we left the insurance companies in charge.
One of the criticisms of Obamacare is rising premiums. You addressed this. In respect to rising premiums, weren't those expected because insurers generally underpriced their plans when the marketplaces first opened in 2014?
Sure. I would not disagree with that, but I think the rise has really been startling to a lot of people. You know, I personally, and I'm just one anecdote, but I've listened to many people similar to my situation. My family has seen our premium more than triple over the last 2 years, and that's not going to be solved with this American healthcare plan. We've seen early estimates with regards to
my household that it'll go up another $500 a month under if this plan goes through.
There isn't an individual mandate in the Republican plan, but there is a penalty if people re-enter the system, as I understand,
right.
And that penalty goes to the insurance companies.
Right.
So there's no incentive to actually buy insurance, and then you're penalized if you actually do. So that you think both of those together will sort of keep people out of the system?
I think people stay out, yeah, and to their detriment, and ultimately to the detriment of all of us who have to pay for those individuals' health care. You know, people can still walk into the emergency department. We see that on a regular basis, people coming in that don't have access to appropriate care.
13th District candidate for Congress, Dr. David Gill, is in the studio during Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. The Congressional Budget Office just released its report on the cost or effect of Donald Care, and that's a phrase President Trump has used. Yet this bill has already passed two committees in the House, and it's scheduled for a floor vote. There were 15 months of deliberation before Obamacare came up for a vote. What's the rush here, do you think?
You tell me, Mike. I don't understand, frankly. You know, and this is in stark contrast to what was going on back there in 2009, 2010, when the Republicans were insisting that the brakes be put on and that we wait for the estimates from the CBO, and they've turned 180 degrees with regards to the speed with which they're driving this through. You know, this president went to Washington with a promise to
drain the swamp. Also, health care for everyone.
Right. And we're not seeing that. You know, it's interesting that you mentioned that. You know, Donald Trump for years did say that he supported a single-payer health care plan. In fact, he even said it at one of the earliest Republican debates in this cycle. And he seems to have gone way off far from that plan that he used to support.
What steps should a bill with such far-reaching effect, what sort of scrutiny should that bill get? You know, this bill that has such far-reaching, healthcare is a huge percent of our economy.
It's one-fifth to one-sixth of our economy, you know, 16 to 20%. And, well, I think that there should be input from the parties that are impacted by it. You know, when you have something that's taking up 15, 20% of your economy, I think that you should be talking with the American Hospital Association and the American Medical Association. And these are groups that have spoken out against the program.
Seniors, the AMA, the HA, AHA,
right.
Also AARP.
Yes, seniors come out. Use a great deal of our healthcare resources, and AARP has stood up against this. And I do think that the leaders within the Republican Party should be listening to those organizations.
This Republican bill to replace the ACA rolls back taxes for the wealthy Americans who helped pay for the ACA, and it rolls back the benefits or the subsidies to middle and working class Americans to actually buy insurance. The tax cuts are an unraveling of how the ACA was paid for, but also, as it turns out, a gift to wealthy Americans. What do you think?
Oh, well, it almost goes without saying. I think it's ridiculous. And it really shines a light on what's going on with health insurance. The CEO of United Healthcare made $66 million last year. That's enough for him to go out and spend $100,000 a day every day on himself for a couple of years. I speak often about the former head of United Healthcare, who, when he retired, received a parting gift of $1.6 billion with a B dollars, enough to spend $100,000 a day on himself every day for 40 plus years. And that's money that people are sending in for their premiums. And that really strikes at the heart of what the problem is. And now they're making that $66 million salary on the part of that CEO. They're going to make that tax deductible for United Healthcare.
Why block grant Medicaid back to the states as part of this reform package from the GOP?
I think it's a part of a federal plan to not take responsibility for the health care financing of the poorest.
A rollback of entitlements?
Yes.
What do you think the result will be? Will we see unequal care from state to state?
Very much so. And we see that today. Let's be clear. We have rationed health care in America today. The bulk of my time in the emergency department is spent doing primary care for people who, even though they now have insurance or Medicaid through Obamacare, they can't find a physician that will see them. You know, we have a multi-tiered system as it is today, and it's only going to get worse under this plan.
Do you have any confidence that states like Illinois, which can't even muster the will to put together a budget, are these states equipped to administer Medicaid?
At this point, no. You know, I think that all we see is failure with respect to that.
Senator Tom Cotton of Arkansas asked House members not to walk the plank for the bill and put the House majority at risk for a bill that doesn't have a chance. Trump has said it will be a bloodbath in 2018 if Congress doesn't repeal and replace Obamacare. What do you think its ultimate chances of being approved in its current form are, and what effect might this Affordable Health Care Act the Republicans are pushing through, what effect might that have on the midterm elections?
You know, to be honest, Mike, I wouldn't hazard a guess with regards to its prospects for going through, but I do think that if it does go through as it's currently written, that President Trump is right, that that will bode poorly for his party in the coming midterm elections. There's, as you indicated early in this conversation, there's ever-growing support for Obamacare. There's 60% of this country now that wants to see the single-payer healthcare system that I've been talking about for 25 years. So to go backwards so in such a strident manner, you know, I think is bad politics on their part.
Republicans are some individual congressmen are in a difficult position here, either having to toe the party line or face the consequences in their districts in 2018. How do you think the 13th might play out?
Well, I think they need to stand up for their constituents. You know, that this adherence to party line is something that I've long spoken out against, and I would hope that Representative Davis would recognize that there's a very substantial portion of the people that live here in Illinois 13 that are dependent on appropriate health care financing, and that for him to get behind this thing is a mistake. And, you know, it would be good for me politically, but that's not what I'm looking for. What I do in the field of politics is done because of my concern for my fellow man, and I don't want to see pain brought to my neighbors.
And what about President Trump's promise? I alluded to this earlier, his promise that everyone would be covered. How will this play out for the president with working class Americans who at this point seem to be hurt by this bill, which is also where he gets a lot of his support?
Yeah,
electoral support.
I think he's forgotten that. And, you know, ultimately, maybe this plays a role in what happens in a Trump re-election campaign.
Okay, Dr. Gill, thanks for your time today on Sound Ideas. We appreciate it.
Thank you, Mike.
Dr. David Gill is an emergency room physician. He's announced as a Democratic candidate running against Congressman Rodney Davis in the 13th District. He's speaking tonight along with candidate Junius Rodriguez at the Stand Up for Justice rally on the lawn of the BCPA. That rally, focused on the bill to replace Obamacare, begins at 5:30. It's Sound Ideas. Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. Illinois State University basketball coach Dan Muller fired off a tweet that Monday that reverberated through college basketball. The viral tweet came on the heels of the Redbirds not receiving an at-large bid Sunday night to play in the upcoming NCAA March Madness tournament. Despite its 27-6 season record, ISU was told it didn't have enough quality wins against strong opponents to be selected. Later Sunday, the lesser prestigious NIT made ISU one of its four number one seeds, and ISU will play UC Irvine tomorrow night in Redbird Arena. GLT's John Norton sat down with ISU head coach Dan Muller in his Redbird office yesterday. Muller outlines what he and his staff expect from UC Irvine and about his tweet the NCAA and teams in the so-called power conferences that have refused to play so-called mid-major schools, including ISU.
If you were going to be on Monday morning, I was going to ask you, boy, it was disappointing Sunday night. You're upset. Players are upset. How are you going to get these guys motivated? And then the tweet comes out on Monday morning. Was it strategic? And in how many ways was it strategic?
No, the only strategy was to use a little humor, but also be serious about a situation that I see and have seen the last few years with the tournament. It's concerning to me. As far as my team, I honestly don't even know what they've read with it or what they've read about it. Now they read everything, so I'm guessing they have recently. Today's been a little bit interesting with the attention it got. I knew it'd get a little national play. It's got more than I thought, which is fine, because my whole thing, as I've said, is the issue is with the committee. It's not with teams that don't schedule us. It's not with other coaches. It's with the explanation and the hypocrisy, in my opinion, of why they choose certain teams over others.
and this has become an issue even more so in the last few years for so-called mid-major teams. Kind of like society, the rich are getting richer, the poor are getting poorer, and mid-majors are getting locked out. It's almost like you have to jump through amazing hurdles just to get to, quote, sit at the big boys' table. As a coach, are there weapons in your arsenal at all that you can use? Tweeting, obviously, is one. Get the media going, maybe getting some guilt going. Is there anything else you can do as a coach?
You know, I'll try to talk to the appropriate people at the NCAA. And again, I've said this. I don't think that those 10 people in that room are trying to do anything but their best. I think they are looking at numbers and deciding what's important to them. I don't know if they understand the issues that go into scheduling. You would assume some do because there are some athletic directors from schools like ours. I don't know if there's pressures, but I'll certainly reach out to the people I think it's appropriate and handle it the right way, and just want to discuss, not only discuss what I think are the problems, but also trying to figure out what the solutions are, because you know, there's a lot of really good teams around the country. The teams that got in instead of us, it means just as much to them as it does to us. I'm happy for them. I hope they win. I don't care who wins. But my point is, when you're making those final decisions, or even when you're seeding teams, you can't just look at one specific, as they say, analytic, which is quality wins, when certain teams don't have opportunities for those.
Is there anything that can be done legislating, like a team has to play 40% of their games on the road before they get to conference?
That'll never happen, nor should it. I'm not a proponent of that.
Why not?
Because each program and each coach needs to do what's best for their program. And within that, you work with the NCAA, and obviously there's rules you have to abide by, a number of games you can play. But other than that, you start legislating that, and I think you're getting way too involved. It's not going to change as far as teams playing different. I say that. I think we just got a home-and-home with Ole Miss because of all this. So hopefully we can follow through with that.
We got a scoop.
Yeah, well, it's on Twitter. Sorry. But I don't want that to happen. I don't think it should happen. I'm not for over-legislation in the NCAA with scheduling. I just want the committee to understand the challenges and not make the excuses of this is why we didn't have you let you in when it's not possible to change.
Okay. We're talking with Illinois State University men's basketball coach Dan Muller. We're in his office on Monday afternoon. Sunday night.
Yeah.
The decision came down. You didn't get in. Like I said, you guys were all upset.
Yes.
And you said at the time, hey, look, you guys get to grieve tonight.
Yep.
When you come back Monday morning, in essence, you said you better have your head screwed on straight. You're going to be sitting next to me on the bench being an assistant coach. It was a good line.
Yep.
How did their players respond today in practice?
They were good. We had a good practice. I'm not saying we're out of the woods yet. And I started off the meeting with telling them I understand. I understand the disappointment. I understand not being excited about being in the NIT in that moment. I understand the emotional investment they've put in, specifically the seniors. But as I've told them since they've been here, life's not fair, number one. But if you're in my program, if you're in this program, we compete. And we have an opportunity to compete together in a very good tournament with the number one seed, which has never been done here, continue this historic season. And I trust that they will do that. Now, I know some will, and I think some are struggling with it because it is emotional. I hope that by game time, everybody's locked in.
UC Irvine is your opponent, first game Wednesday night. How do you match up against them? Have you learned anything in the last 18 hours?
Oh, yeah. We've watched plenty of film, watching right now. First thing is they're huge. They are enormous. They've got a 7'2" starter, 250 pounds. They got a 6'10", 300-pound guy off the bench. They've got another 6'10 starter. They're really, really big. They've got an incredible scorer who was player of the year in their league at the two, shoots it, a dynamic player. Obviously, they're well-coached. They've won. I think they won their league 2 years in a row. I know they made the tournament last year. It's going to be a tough game. One of the great things about postseason play is you get so used to playing teams in your league that know each other. They know all your plays. They know your play calls. They know what to expect. There's just a breath of fresh air because a lot of the old plays that didn't work against those that work. And so it's fun. The more you win, the more fun it is. But, again, it'll be a quality opponent coming in.
Well, you do have Hawaii as a common opponent. It looks like the only one. Does that help at all, or is that long ago it doesn't matter?
That was so long ago. I did see their score. They beat Hawaii by a bunch like we did.
Mm-hmm.
They've had overtime at Cal, 5-point losses to some really good teams. Mm-hmm. I mean, they're clearly – they got three senior starters. We may make sure emotionally we're right. That is a challenge, not only for our team, but probably the most of the teams that barely didn't get in, is just getting your mind ready to compete when you've been let down so much at that age. But as always, if we're locked in and everybody's ready to go, I feel I like our chances.
Final question. This is an extremely likable team.
Yeah. Yes, it is.
Extremely likable from a fan's perspective.
I like them almost all the time.
Does that come from you? Does that come from your fellow coaches? Does that come from the players? What percentage?
Well, it starts with the players, number one. Now, our culture and our program, and we bring guys in and try to do a really good job of mentoring them and teach them how to act and be respectful and appreciative. I think those are very important qualities in anybody. And so I hope you see as they're with us, they're even more and more likable, or even more and more appreciative and respectful. But it starts with the players and their parents. We try to recruit good kids. It is a fun group. It is a group that plays hard, and it's a group that's represented this community in the right way for a long time. And we've had some mix-ups over the years, but it is a fun group to coach.
Illinois State University basketball coach Dan Muller, thank you so much for your time.
You got it.
Good luck tomorrow night against Irvine.
We'll take it. Thank you.
Illinois State University men's basketball coach Dan Muller speaking with GLT's John Norton. Though passed up for an NCAA tournament bid, ISU is a number one seed in the NIT tournament and will host UC Irvine Wednesday night at 8:30 in Redbird Arena. You're listening to Sound Ideas. On a previous episode of Animal House, veterinarian Matt Fraker alerted pet owners of the five most common and troublesome genetic diseases in dogs. Now it's the cat's turn, and as Fraker points out, being forewarned could save your cat's life. Laura Kennedy has more in this edition of Animal House.
So again, we're referencing a recent edition of Clinician's Brief to give you a heads up about the five most common genetic diseases of cats. And coming in at number five is hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, or HCM. Dr. Matt Fraker of the Prairie Oak Veterinary Center says it's the most common heart problem for cats. And it's very frustrating.
Difficult to treat, difficult to manage, often results in a syndrome where because the walls thicken in the heart, the blood flow becomes irregular in the heart, forming clots, and these clots will pop out the aorta, shoot down to where it splits to the femoral arteries, and we get what's called a saddle thrombus, and it shuts down the back half of the cat in a pretty painful fashion, often results in euthanasia. And
shuts down the back half of the cat?
Shuts the blood supply to the back legs, so their legs fall asleep. It's not really neurologic, but it looks like they're paralyzed. And it's painful, like your legs are falling asleep. So these cats are often very, very vocal, and they can't move. Although there are management options for saddle thrombi with HCM, most often, because the cats that you can get through that initial traumatic episode, I think there's some study out there that says 90% of them will have it happen again in a short period of time. That's often a time when a decision to euthanize an animal is from HCM.
My cat Jeeves had this, and he was diagnosed when he was about 10 years old. He lived to be 19, and twice a day for all these years, I gave him Atenolol?
There's several heart medicines that are out there to manage these.
How effective are they, though?
That's what's up in the air. There's some studies that show that cats with management are lasting as long as cats without management. So in our clinic, our personal clinic's approach is to look at the cat. And if these cats are able to be medicated without torturing the owners, torturing the cats, then we'll usually institute some type of therapy to try to soften the heart's workload. If we have a cat that's just ridiculous to pill, then we say, all right, you have a heart disease. It may ultimately be what takes your kitty cat away from you, and we're going to let it go. HCM can be found in any critter. Ragdoll and Maine Coons are pretty heavily represented, but a lot of the exotic breeds, but not just exotic breeds. I mean, you'll get some random bred cats that can show this disease also.
I love that random bred, as in mixed breed.
That's the politically correct for kitty mutt. Random bred cat, random bred feline.
Okay, that was number five. What's number four, top genetic disease for cats?
Number four is polycystic kidney disease, or PKD. Persians often get this, Himalayan, some of those more of the Asian-derived breeds can get this disease. I believe there's a DNA test out there to look for that. So the cats that have PKD, many of these cats will develop a kidney failure at an earlier age.
What's that look like? How do we know that our cat is getting kidney failure?
Oh, actually, that's an excellent question, because not polycystic kidney disease, just generally kidney disease in cats is certainly one of the most frequent diseases we see in the feline breed. And they usually start by drinking a lot and having increased amounts of urine in their litter boxes. And then that can lead over time to weight loss, loss of appetite, and toxin buildup from the kidney failure.
So you see that, you go to your vet right away.
Anytime any cat starts drinking more than normal, and it is usually obvious. Cats are, you know, they're pretty subtle about getting their water. A lot of these cats are, if you're feeding canned diets, getting a lot of their moisture out of their food. But cats who start getting truly what we call polydipsic, drinking a lot of water, it's evident. An owner will usually notice that the cat spends more time at the bowl, and that's always an indication to have blood work done on your kitty cat.
Are there any supplements we could give our cats if this is a DNA type of thing to help maybe forestall it?
Yeah, managing kidney failure is just that. It's forestalling. Fatty acids, a good source of fatty acids, not just...
What's a good source of fatty
acids?
Well,
finding a product that's like Nutramax is an excellent company. They make excellent nutritional supplements because they quality control them. These don't have to be quality controlled versus a little bit of oil out of the pan type thing, actually getting a fatty acid product that's balanced. That's been shown to have gentle anti-inflammatory properties that helps with the kidney failure. There's kidney diets that minimize the workload on the kidney. Many cats will tolerate sub-Q fluid administration by the owners, which is a great way to lengthen a cat's lifespan with kidney failure. Since hydration is the critical component of preventing illness from kidney failure, we'll often teach owners how to give them fluids. We call it sub-Q fluids. We're just putting the fluids in between their shoulder blades where we give a lot of vaccinations or other injections, and many cats are very tolerant of that.
What's number three top genetic disease for cats?
The number three is lymphocytic or plasmacytic inflammatory disease.
Never heard of that.
Well, you know what you have? A lot of owners have. What's interesting is we haven't presented it as a genetic disease.
Oh.
One form of it's inflammatory bowel disease, IBD, which is pretty frequent in kitty cats. Some of that is diet responsive. The teeth. We'll see a version of lymphocytic plasmacytic inflammatory disease where cats get wicked inflammation directed at where their teeth meet their gum lines.
That's bad.
It is bad. And what's interesting is for years, we felt that this might be a management issue. And I think it was largely a reason many veterinarians, the veterinary community, pushed back against canned foods, blaming canned food for rotting out these teeth.
But it's not canned food?
No, it's a genetic predisposition. And cats who have it, it's very clear that they have it. Their gum lines are just incredibly, you look at their gums, they're very inflamed. They'll sometimes have bad breath. They'll start actually getting pockets in their teeth, like someone's been dripping acid on their teeth.
My cat Dante had that.
Yes. And so we used to use antibiotics on these, thinking it was bacterial infection of the mouth. We would do hard food to try to keep the teeth clean. And in fact, the treatment of choice, which sounds horrible, but it's incredibly effective, is removing the affected teeth, which often, in some cats, involves removing all of the teeth.
What, you mean they're like the bumble with no teeth at all?
Exactly.
Oh my
goodness.
What
happens is all that inflammation goes away. The mouth becomes healed, the breath becomes better.
Can they eat?
Oh, we've had toothless cats who thoroughly enjoyed their dry food. But a lot of those animals, we will move to a softer, more moist food. And again, the whole dietary approach with cats, keep them on dry, keep them on dry, keep them on dry. We're going to address this in number two, actually. But that mindset's changing, where canned food is certainly low carb, try to minimize carbs as low as possible. Low carb canned food may be an excellent dietary choice for your cats.
What's number two genetic disease?
Because
for cats?
Of number two, which is diabetes mellitus.
Oh, dear.
Diabetic cats. We see it frequently. Some of them are headed that way for regardless of what you do for them. Many of them are going to get it because they're going to get obese, and that obesity is going to create the insulin condition or the insulin resistant condition that gives us diabetes. So here's where we go back and revisit this nutritional philosophy. There was some work done that determined that cats' appetites are turned off by moisture in their food. Here we are, we're pushing dry food on all of our cats. Well, there's no moisture in the dry food, so they overeat. Indoor cats have a remarkably low calorie need, and they certainly don't need carbs. Cats should be treated as carb allergic animals. So most of our cats are a little overweight to very overweight. And most people don't think their cats are overweight, or the cats that are really overweight, they think are just a little big boned. The problem, especially in the male cats, is these middle-aged, overweight male cats are trying to become diabetic. Now, with diabetes, cats can be diabetic for a very long time before they show signs, longer than humans, longer than dogs, because of the way their kidneys handle sugar. They can be diabetic for a very long time before they start becoming clinical. If your cat is male and overweight and 4 or 5 years or older, there's tests your veterinarian can do to make sure they're not diabetic quietly. The reason that's important is because when we diagnose a diabetic cat preclinically, before they're drinking a lot, urinating a lot, losing weight in their hypermetabolic state, we can cure them with diet. We can cure those cats. We can avoid the insulin injections altogether, avoid lifelong blood draws, lifelong injections, by just changing their diet back to usually a low-carb canned food. This may be less the genetic ones than the ones that have been created diabetic by their obesity, but it is a fixable disease if it's caught early enough.
All right, what's the number one genetic disease for cats? Drum roll, please.
Drum roll, please. Well, this is without question the most frustrating cat problem out there. Everybody knows it. Feline lower urinary tract disease, FLUTD. Here again, a disease that we misconceived forever, where we thought cats that were urinating out of their boxes or getting crystals or having problems with their bladder, that these guys all had bacterial infections and needed to be treated with antibiotics, when in fact, most of these cats are having a sterile hemorrhagic cystitis. There isn't a bacterial cause. We don't know. We think stress may contribute, where humans can get like a gastric ulcer from stress. Cats can get hemorrhagic bladder disease from stress. We'll see it a lot in multiple cat households with cats who are stressed by having the other cats in the house. They start getting inflammatory bladder disease. This can lead to plugs of cells and red blood cells, and male cats block. Everyone knows about the blocking male cat. It's really terrible.
It is.
Their urinary tracts become very small as they exit through their penis. Female cats don't block because of that shorter, wider urinary tract. It's very expensive. It's very difficult to manage. It frequently recurs. Even with management, it can be a recurrent problem.
But can we prevent it?
There are some things to prevent. Again, with the genetic predisposition, some cats are just waiting to get it. It's really one of those things where having a single cat or two cats in a household that get along, when you start adding in 3 or 4 cats, so often we see this in multiple cat households.
They get totally stressed out.
When we see a cat that we feel has this syndrome, is we try to set them up so they have their own place in the house and their own litter box. Now, there's a rule out there, everyone knows, if you have 4 cats, have 5 litter boxes, 3 cats, 4 litter boxes, kind of, that's great. If you have a cat that has feline lower urinary tract disease, and it's urinating out of the box and it's getting hemorrhagic cystitis, all of those boxes belong to the other cats. You could put 20 boxes in that house, and that cat, they're the least dominant cat in the household. And in their opinion, all 20 of those litter boxes belong to the dominant cat. So it's not fixing the problem. What we recommend doing is trying to find a space for that cat that is that cat's and that cat's alone, that the kitty cat has its own litter box. And some people feel like, well, we're isolating our cat. They hate that. No, actually, it may be very much what they need.
That's Dr. Matt Fraker from the Prairie Oak Veterinary Center in Normal. For the cat inclined who would like to add a feline to their home, how about considering the Animal House Pet of the Week? It's Tina. This 1-year-old domestic short hair is a natty tabby with a mild form of cerebellar hypoplasia. This sometimes causes her to be unstable when walking or jumping. Despite this, she requires very little extra care. Tina is sweet and affectionate and eager to be a part of your home. You can find Tina at the Humane Society of Central Illinois. I'm Laura Kennedy.
If you have a pet-related question for one of the Animal House team of experts, you can send it to WGLT.org. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal. Go to WGLT.org to find Laura Kennedy's Animal House interviews and the rest of today's show. Thanks to John Norton and Willis Kern. Also, thanks to Bloomington Mayor Terry Renner and Dr. David Gill, running for Congress in the 13th District, for joining us live today on Sound Ideas. We want to know what you think of this program and the interviews you hear. Share your thoughts about the show at Facebook.com/WGLTFM or tweet, use the hashtag Sound Ideas. I'm at Mike McCurdy. We're all at WGLT News. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.